Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, we've got Medicaid, marijuana, hate crimes, polygamy, much more. Joining me this morning in studio, Tribune Justice reporter Jennifer Dobner is here. Hi, Jennifer.
Good morning.
Also with us, columnist Paul Raleigh. Paul, good morning to you.
Good morning.
We have environmental reporter Brian Maffley is in the house. Brian, hello there.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's nice to be in here.
It's great to always have you. And government and politics editor Dan Harry is with us. Dan, good morning.
Good morning.
And you, of course, are welcome to join us. What are the headlines that caught your eye this week? You can put your comments on the website, sltrib.com. You can also tweet us to the hashtag TribTalk or call us. 801-355-TALK is that number. 801-355-8255. So much happened this week. We're just going to have to really clip through a lot of things. Let's start with medical marijuana. So Dan, two bills that would allow medical marijuana as an option cleared a legislative committee. Can you explain the different approaches?
I'm going to put it very simply because that's the way I understand things. And that is that one allows THC. So it's a whole plant medical marijuana. And THC, is the active ingredient of marijuana. And the other one does not have THC. And the one that does not have THC is also a lot more restrictive about who would be able to obtain it for medical purposes. No children, for instance, would be allowed to have it. In the other bill, children would be able to use the medical marijuana with, of course, consent of their parents. Hmm. So the one is a very, very tightly restricted. And those who are encouraging that are kind of say, if we're going to go down this pathway, let's do it very carefully and let's take it, you know, one step at a time. So let's do this.
Okay.
And the advocates for the other bill are saying, well, wait a second. You're choosing who is going to be helped and who is not by this bill. You're cutting out a huge range of people that could be benefiting from this, including children. And, you know, the alternative in many cases is these very strong opioid painkillers like oxycodone, which are very debilitating and very addictive. So, you know, there's some pretty good arguments on all sides of this.
Mm. Well, this week, the LDS Church weighed in, issuing a statement. How did they come down on these two bills?
Well, they oppose the one that has the allows the THC. And they, you know, warned about unintended consequences. And the way this came about was very interesting. It was not like last year when the LDS Church weighed in on the anti-discrimination bill, or the year before that when they said, don't touch our liquor laws, leave the Zion curtain alone. It was kind of very much behind the scenes. And our reporter, Robert Gerke, was hearing from Mark Madsen, the sponsor of the bill, and others, that behind the scenes, the church lobbyists were saying, don't pass this bill. But officially, they were neutral. And so he pressed the church on it and said, I'm being told that you oppose this. No, we have no official position on this. And he told them, I am going to do a story saying all of these folks say you're opposing it. So kind of at the last minute, a week ago today, they issued a statement saying they were opposed. So it was kind of like smoking them out a little bit.
Hmm, hmm. Well, I mean, clearly they have lobbyists like everybody else, but they do sort of pick and choose their public battles. Raleigh, what are the consequences for Senator Mark Madsen's bill, the one that is more permissive, the whole plant?
Well, with my experience at the legislature over the, you know, a few decades, I would guess that with the Mormon Church coming out against it, it's dead on arrival. We'll see. There has been some exceptions over the years when the legislature has done something maybe a little contrary to what the church has said, but that's very, very rare. The church is just the elephant in the room. It's caused kind of a family feud because Mark Madsen was clearly perturbed at the church. I mean, I remember reading his quote saying, if you're going to put your thumb on the scale, you should at least give the reasons why that you're doing this. I mean, Mark Madsen's the grandson of Ezra Taft Benson, the former president of the church. And he actually has I don't know if he still does, but for years had a little statue, kind of like a bubblehead doll or something, but a little statue of the Ammon, who was a Book of Mormon prophet, on his Senate desk. I mean, so, you know, showing how much he's into that church. But he seems to be a little annoyed with the church right now for taking that position. So, but I feel that with the church coming out against it, I think that the THC bill will have a hard time passing.
Dan, is this going to be an election year issue?
Well, it could be. You have people out there now talking about a potential ballot initiative. And, you know, we had a Tribune poll recently that showed about 61% of Utah voters would approve medical marijuana. It didn't get into the details of what kind of bill. But you have this kind of general broad support out there, and you have people that are very committed to this. And, you know, it's the kind of issue that might lend itself to that. That said, it's very, very hard to get an initiative on the ballot. You know, the legislature, which is very jealous of its power, has made it very difficult for citizens to get on the ballot. But this maybe is a potential issue for that.
We will continue to watch that. What's the status in the legislature right now?
Both are headed to the full Senate. And there are several senators who are saying what we need to do is put these on the floor at the same time and compare them and debate them at the same time. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing that's what will happen.
Okay, let's move on. Last week on this show, we talked about the parole board audit. This week, two bureaucrats have resigned. The governor said that an investigation of Utah's probation and parole system is underway. Why is this parole board in such trouble, Dan?
Well, they've had some issues, and one of them is communication. These folks are getting out on parole, and they are committing new crimes and being arrested. But in the case of the officer who was shot, Doug Barney, I believe the guy was arrested but then was released because the probation and parole didn't pick him up. And recently, there also was an audit, legislative audit of probation and parole. And it said that they were still doing things with paper. They weren't computerizing their data. They weren't communicating by, you know, electronically. They were all doing it with paper. And it seems like kind of a mess of a system that they've got there.
Yeah. I think it was 18,000 cases all on paper in 1 year. Kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Raleigh, the auditors were quite pointed in their assessment of the agency, pointing out the shortcomings. I mean, how is this going to affect the agency during the session when legislators are looking at money?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it was interesting to see that the governor's response, and I have to think that that might have come in, you know, a little bit of a result of this being an election year, and he's going to get a challenge in the Republican convention, and he wants to show that he's strong. I mean, obviously, these problems have been building up for quite some time, and you have to wonder why nobody's been paying attention up until now. With the audit, there could be some but you're right. You know, with money being a big issue, I mean, I could see something like maybe being put on a study committee. They like to kick the can down the road a lot, especially when, you know, all this is kind of boiling up now and they're in the middle of the session. So, I'd be surprised if anything really meaningful happened this session in the legislature. You know, Gary Herbert now has come on record to show how he's going to be tough on these guys. And once again, you know, the cynic in me says, you know, where has he been up until now?
You're nodding, Dan.
One of the real issues here, too, is that we've just passed this big criminal justice reform, which means there's a lot more people who are not going to go to prison who would have a couple of years ago. Mainly these are substance abusers and drug users. That they, you know, the whole philosophy is let's direct these people into treatment, into prevention programs, get them job counseling and other help, and not put them in prison where really it doesn't do anybody any good, especially if they're nonviolent offenders. But so this is going to, we're going to see a dramatic increase in these folks who are diverted from the prison route. And if they don't have their act together at probation and parole, you're just begging for some huge problems there.
Yeah, Jennifer? No, sorry. I misread your cue. Some of the proponents of the Medicaid expansion have said, look, this filters into that criminal justice reform discussion
absolutely.
In a big way.
Oh, absolutely. You know, when they passed this criminal justice reform, it was based on the assumption that there was going to be Medicaid expansion, and there was this huge flow of federal money that was going to be coming in paying for these treatment programs. Well, the state is still not done anything with Medicaid expansion, so that money isn't there. So, you know, you can blame probation and parole, you can blame other parts of the system, but you've also got to blame the legislature for not moving on Medicaid expansion. And if they're not going to move on Medicaid expansion, are they going to come up with the funding themselves? Because they have now pushed us down this path on criminal justice reform, and a big part of the reason of that was they're going to build a new prison, which is a very pet project of the legislature. They are bound and determined to have that happen. But it's going to be exactly the same size as the current prison. When if we had gone on the trajectory we were on before, you'd see, I think it's a doubling of the prison population over the next 30 years.
So they're absolutely banking on criminal justice reform succeeding so fewer people are in the prison.
They have. I mean, they've placed the state in the position of, you know, there are no other alternatives now.
Well, and I am going to jump in now because I cover the other end of the system, the courts, and I'm here to tell you that there aren't enough treatment beds anywhere. I mean, consistently in court hearings, you hear, well, Your Honor, I'm trying to get into X, but it'll be another 60 to 90 days before I can maybe get a bed, and I don't want to go, you know. So they've got a deal with the treatment end of things because people who have substance abuse problems often and, you know, reoffend into, you know, exceedingly more violent crimes. So it's a problem. But the legislature, in my memory, is not big on funding treatment.
No, they're not. And, you know, you had an unusual situation where the Chief Justice of the state, Matthew Durand, issued a warning, used his State of the Judiciary, which is usually, things are great, you know, we're working well, we've had this many cases. He issued a very stark warning that if they don't come up with the funding for this, for the treatment, that and they're funneling all these folks away from prison, we're going to see an increase in crime. And that's the last thing a legislature wants to hear in an election year, that we're going to see an increase in crime.
Sure. Well, let's segue into Medicaid. Lawmakers are talking again. We had three bills at a hearing yesterday. Drastically different approaches, though. Do you want to explain sort of the three methods?
Again, I'll keep things simple because that's the way my mind works. One is a full Medicaid expansion, and that was Gene Davis, who just says, look, you know, you can rail against Obamacare and the president, but, you know, the fact is this is the best way to go.
He's the Senate majority or minority leader.
Minority leader, right. And the other one is kind of a middle road, sort of a healthy Utah approach that the governor and legislative leaders had put together, which is, you know, expanding Medicaid, but they can say we're not just following what President Obama wants us to do. And the other one is just a very bare bones expansion that would help sort of the frailest and the most impoverished people get health care coverage. So those are the three approaches.
And yesterday, a line of doctors, providers endorsed some kind of movement on the issue. Earlier in the week, we reported on some pretty dramatic testimony from Carolyn Tuft, a survivor of the Trolley Square shooting. What was her message?
Well, she still has pellets inside her body from being shot during the Trolley Square rampage, and her daughter was killed. And she cannot hold a job, she said, because of the chronic pain that she suffers. You know, we're going back to, again, to the, you know, the opioids use and the debilitating effects of some painkillers. That she just can't get her act together, and she's kind of begging for help. She's uninsured.
She used that word, beg.
Yeah, she did. She said, I'm here to beg you for Medicaid expansion. And she said, you know, I'm an example of the people who should be covered but can't get covered because the legislature hasn't done anything on this Medicaid expansion.
Paul Raleigh, we have lots of voices chiming in on this, and all of these issues are related. Medicaid, the criminal justice reform, medical marijuana even. I mean, do you think that a compromise is possible this time around? Is the message getting through?
Well, first of all, Gene Davis's bill, I would guess, would be dead on arrival. I mean, he's the lead. You know, when you say he's the Senate Minority Leader, that means he's the leader of five members of the Senate out of 29. And, you know, it seems to be a matter of course that the Democrats are almost irrelevant. I mean, the majority doesn't really care what they say or what they think. The last year, the Senate went along with Gary Herbert's, you know, passed his version of Medicaid expansion. And then the House killed it without taking any responsibility whatsoever on any individual votes by doing it in a secret caucus, so nobody knows how the individual members voted on it. A lot of people think that was Speaker Greg Hughes protecting his caucus, you know, as we're coming into an election year now this year, because, you know, a vote either way could cause anger toward individual legislators. So I don't have a lot of high hope. I mean, I could see the Senate passing Gary Herbert's version again. I don't see the House being any different than it was last year. You've got a lot of big number of representatives in the House who are basically got elected and are there and are, you know, retaining their reelections on the issue of hating Barack Obama, and it would all stem from the Tea Party tsunami of 2010. And that's the mentality you've got now in the House. So I don't have a lot of optimism that they're really going to do much in the House and get anything passed. And I could see them kicking the can down the road once again.
Is that your analysis, Dan?
I think there's a chance, maybe a decent chance, that they'll pass some kind of very bare bones Medicaid expansion.
Medicaid expansion did come out with public support in our Tribune Hinckley Institute of Politics poll.
Yeah, it was split. And part of that, I think, was the way we asked the question. We thought, in fairness, you know, we should put the price tag on it, and it was a $78 million state expense. What we didn't put is that would bring, you know, many times that in federal dollars. So even then, though, I think it was 46-48% supported it. So, yeah, there is support out there.
Okay. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in Salt Lake City, throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We do need to take a break, but we'll be right back in a minute.
This is Chris from Springfield, Illinois. I listen to Bullseye because sometimes I need something that can make me laugh, teach me, and then leave me feeling totally amazed.
I'm Jesse Thorne. I'll talk to comedian Todd Glass about his memoir, The Todd Glass Situation, and I'll also sit down with Raffi, a beloved children's performer, on the next Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Join us Saturday afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Logan Regional Hospital Nutrition Services, helping people live a healthier life through programs directed to prevent diabetes and heart disease. Information at loganregional.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce here in studio with Jennifer Doebner, Paul Raleigh, Brian Maffley, and Dan Harry, all of the Salt Lake Tribune. And again, if you want to talk about the week's news, you can join us. Tweet us to the hashtag TribTalk or put your comments on the website, sltrib.com. You can also call 801-355-TALK. Let's continue a little bit with some more action at Utah's Capitol. A clean energy plan by Rocky Mountain Power is getting some poor reviews from many people out there. Brian, explain what the STEP plan would do.
Okay, that stands for Sustainable Transportation and Energy Plan that Rocky Mountain Power, Utah's largest utility, has proposed. which envisions substantial investments in energy efficiency, electric vehicle charging stations, changes to the grid in ways that allow them to ramp down Wasatch Front power plants during times of inversions, things like that. And on paper, these look like fabulous ideas. Why would anyone oppose these? Well, the big problem from the consumer standpoint is how do you pay for these? And the Office of Consumer Services has come out strongly against legislation that would enable Rocky Mountain Power to make these changes. But not just that's a consumer advocate employed by the state, but it's not just them. It's the industrial energy users, the Utah Mining Association on one end, and at the other end, groups like Heal Utah and Breathe Utah, very strong clean air groups that support clean air measures.
And nobody likes this plan.
Yeah. No. There's provisions that they do like. It's just buried in the details are troubling elements that enable Rocky Mountain Power, allegedly, Rocky Mountain Power is a different take on this, but it allows the utility to pass all these costs off to consumers, to the ratepayers, and which is troubling in that that none of the company shareholders will help pay for these on the one end. And so at the other end of is what Rocky Mountain Power is proposing is to do away with a cost-sharing program. And this is kind of buried into the minutia of utility regulation in Utah. But under the current rules, there's a 70-30 cost-sharing plan with Rocky Mountain Power where ratepayers pay 70% of the energy costs, Rocky Mountain Power 30. They're proposing to have that change to enable the utility to be reimbursed 100% of those costs. Normally, those are decisions made by the Utah Public Service Commission. And so the unifying complaint against this bill from this disparate group is that it's taking this important decision-making ability away from an agency that has the expertise to make these decisions in a way that reflects the public interest and hands it off to the legislature, where its decisions are largely political. So that's in a nutshell why these groups oppose it.
Mm. You mentioned that a bill needs to be passed to sort of clear the way for some of these major changes.
Yeah.
It was the bill was reviewed at a hearing yesterday on Capitol Hill. How did lawmakers respond, and what kind of testimony did you hear?
Yeah. Wow, it was a very long, I mean, it seemed like hours, a couple hours of presentations. And it wasn't all against it. There were some groups that are involved in clean coal technology, quote-unquote clean coal technology, that were supportive of it because it would help free up investment to do further development of that technology. And, of course, Rocky Mountain Power would love to figure out a way to clean up coal. They rely heavily on coal as a generating source. Utah has a lot of it. However, there were many, many groups whose lobbyists and executive directors and so forth highly criticized this bill for the reasons I just explained. And I think those arguments really resonated with the Senate Public Utilities Committee. Most of the members, however, did vote to advance the bill. Wayne Harper, Republican of
Taylorsville,
voted against. And I think they wanted to have the entire Senate be able to debate this proposal. It does not have a clear shot toward easy passage at all.
Paul Raleigh, are you looking forward to that full Senate debate? And what are some of the points that you think lawmakers will find a little sticky?
Well, I personally am not looking forward to the Senate debate. One big problem with this is it's so complicated. And Brian mentioned this before, but see, the Public Service Commission, they've got staff. And their staff is made up of experts and technical people. And so they've got the ability and the staff and the expertise to make better informed decisions on these very complicated issues like this, where, like Brian said, the legislature is a political body. They rely on their legislative staff to advise them. And other than that, they get all their information from lobbyists. And so there would be very little expertise in these very technical kinds of issues in the legislature, and even their staff. Their expertise is knowing how to write bills and research bills. It's not in these very technical, scientific type issues that the Public Service Commission is much better situated to understand and to make better, more informed decisions. I don't know how it's going to play out. I know that you've got all these groups against it from various, from one end of this political spectrum to another. There always seem to be some suspicions with public utilities and what their motives are. And there's always been the argument about how much should, and on these initiatives that public utilities take on, how much responsibility should the shareholders bear, seeing as how they're also going to benefit from the profits, and how much should the taxpayers bear?
Well, Brian, it'll be an interesting discussion moving forward. Do you see any additional information that's going to come out of the woodwork, or is it already as complicated as it's going to get?
I don't see how it could get any more complicated, actually. But I'm sure more and more information will be coming out, especially if this gets into the House. I think you'll see a redoubling of the arguments against it and for it. Mm-hmm. When I've talked to Rocky Mountain Power about it, it just sounds like such a great idea. We can, and they've talked about how this bill would enable them to pay down the debt associated with their remaining coal-fired power plants, and that way they could shut them down earlier without a sudden hit to the ratepayers. Well, that sounds that could be great, but there seems to be a lot of little pieces of this hidden away that various interest groups really don't like.
Hmm. We'll continue to watch that. Tribune reporter Brian Maffley. Let's turn to the death penalty. And one state senator wants to scrap it. So, Jennifer, what's the story?
He does. Steve Urquhart, a Republican out of St. George, is working on a bill. It's not out yet. That would repeal the death penalty in Utah. It would leave in place the sentences for the 9 men who are currently on death row, but it would take it off the table in the future.
Okay. According to our recent Tribune Hinckley Institute of Politics poll, Utahns favor capital punishment as an option for the most heinous crimes. So this could be an uphill battle?
Well, probably it's an uphill battle, although since 2012, the legislature has been having some conversation about some of the troubles or problems with carrying out capital punishment. Drugs are one problem. We see that across the country. Getting the right drugs to carry out lethal injection is one issue. Of course, the legislature responded last year by reinstating the firing squad it was already a default option, so it was sort of a doubling down on the default option last mm-hmm. year. The other problem is the financial end of this. Utah spends an additional almost $1.7 million per person on death row between the time of conviction and the time of execution, which I think is roughly about 25 years on average between the time of conviction and the time you actually are put to death. And that's on top of the roughly $40,000 a year it costs to keep you incarcerated when every year if you get a life without the possibility of parole sentence.
So why did Senator Urquhart say, we need to do this and we need to do it now?
Well, he said... at this time in history, we should be having this conversation. Number one. Also, he thinks that the government doesn't do everything right. There's plenty of evidence that suggests that people from death row have been exonerated across the country. There's close to 200 people. Roughly an estimate of 4% of everyone on death row is actually innocent, by some people's statistics. So he thinks, you know, it's the ultimate punishment and government makes mistakes, and given the cost, given the increasing problems with easy access to, you know, the right drug cocktail, we've seen a number of botched executions across the country, that maybe it's time to just take it off the table. He also said, you know, personal evolution. Over time, 16 years of the legislature, thinking about these issues, talking with friends and smart people in places who study these things, that he's had a change of opinion.
Hmm. Does he have allies on Capitol Hill?
Surprisingly, House Speaker Greg Hughes said that he also opposes the death penalty, which I think maybe surprised a lot of people, and me among them. And he has lots of allies. The Libertas Institute, which is sort of a libertarian-leaning think tank in Utah, they actually have driven some of this. They have had a lot of conversations with Urquhart about this. The Statewide Prosecutors Association has not taken a position. But the ACLU, a lot of the church groups, you know, there are plenty of people lining up who think that this is a good idea.
The same lawmaker introduced a hate crimes bill yesterday.
Yes.
And what would this bill do?
So Urquhart would like to strengthen the criminal penalties for hate crimes. Utah has three existing hate crimes laws. The first was passed in 1992, and there were subsequent bills. I think the last one passed in 2006. None of them do the things that most hate crimes do. Number one is define a hate crime as a crime of bias, and including in that a list of categories, protected classes, if you will, race, religion, gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, things like that, which have been upheld by the Supreme Court as constitutional. We've never had that, and therefore the bill has been really unenforceable. Prosecutors have not used it. Since 1992, the state has collected data on hate crimes. There have been close to 1,300 of them. There's only one known prosecution that anyone can find, and it was tossed out on appeal because the Supreme Court here said we don't really have a hate crime statute. What we have is a crime in the act of trying to, you know, carry out your constitutional right statute. And so they haven't been able to use it. One portion of our law is a sentencing enhancement. It's the only thing that works is a sentencing enhancement, but there's really no data on how that has been used or not been used.
Hmm. Interestingly, Jennifer reported that Senator Urquhart said that he voted against this kind of legislation in the past. Mm-hmm. So we have him switching on a couple of key issues. It's not every day that you hear a politician say that he's changed his mind. Dan?
It's very true with Urquhart, especially. He came into the legislature, I don't know how long he's been there, 12 years,
16.
Mm-hmm. Very conservative. You know, he's from St. George, very conservative district down there. But he's changed on a lot of these issues, and it's been quite impressive because I think, you know, unlike folks who do it for political reasons and political gain, he's sincerely changed his opinion. I mean, I don't think a lot of these bills necessarily help him in his district. And I think he's said that he's not going to seek re-election. So you can kind of take the political motivation out of that for him.
Is he going for broke, Paul Raleigh?
Yeah, I believe so. I think that he might have been in trouble in his district had he chose to run for re-election because of his anti-discrimination bill that he got through, and which protects gays and lesbians as a class in employment and housing discrimination. And he's got a very conservative area down there, so that didn't sit well with a lot of his constituents. But I think he's decided that, now that he's decided that he's not going to run for re-election, he has evolved, and he has. I've talked to him several times about these bills, and he's very committed and very sincere. And I think he believes he's just trying to do the right thing. And now that he's not running for re-election, he doesn't have to worry about the political consequences. And if he doesn't get them passed, at least he can get a good discussion going. I'd like to just on the death penalty. Jennifer, said all the reasons why the arguments for getting rid of the death penalty and stuff. I think Utah has got an example of one of the best reasons ever to get rid of the death penalty, and that is the Laffertys. You've got two brothers who committed this heinous crime together in the 1980s. They murdered their sister-in-law and her 11-month-old baby daughter. So they did it together. They committed the same crime. They planned it out together. It was premeditated. They had two different trials because while in prison, Ron, the older brother, tried to commit suicide, and so he was in the hospital for a while. So they went ahead with Dan's trial and then did Ron's later. Ron got the death penalty by the jury. Dan did not. So here you got the same crime. And Dan was actually the one who murdered the baby, while Ron murdered the mother. And so it just shows how arbitrary this can be and how, unjust it can be, really.
Yeah. Well, and this is Speaker Hughes's point, that it feels arbitrary to him and he can't really figure out how you get there when you have, in one case, a capital crime is in fact a capital crime and someone is put to death, and in the other case, it isn't. And prosecutors, I will say this, I checked with the court system, there have been 58 in the last 5 years of capital level crimes. Not a single one of them has resulted in a capital punishment. The last person to join death row is Floyd Eugene Maestas in 2008. We have very rare executions in Utah.
And I can say, I think the turning point was when we passed a few years ago the possibility of a life sentence without parole. And that made a huge difference because, juries were always worried that if they sentenced someone to life, the parole board had the power to release them at any time. Mm-hmm. And that was the case, even in fact, with the Mark Hoffman. Mm-hmm. Even though the judge and the jury said, we want him to spend the rest of his life in prison, it was entirely up to the Board of Pardons. But with that sentence now of life without possibility of parole, it sort of takes away that motivation. And it sort of took the air out of the death penalty.
And I would say that prosecutors use it now as a bargaining chip. They'll file a capital crime, and then within a period of time, you see that pled down. That's the pressure to get a plea agreement. And I know that for families, it's much better, I think, for them to have it be done. Like if you are the child of Maureen Hunsaker, who was killed in 86 or 88, and mid-80s. Ralph Menzies is still on death row, and you were 12, and now you're 40, and every time, every year, he's in a hearing for an appeal, you have to relive that every single time. So I think a lot of people have a lot of trouble. It's a lot of difficulty with that. It's like ripping off the Band-Aid every time.
We need to speed through to another issue. So let's leave Capitol Hill. Above the fold headline today in the Tribune, the arrest of Cliven Bundy, that anti-federal government activist who had a standoff with the federal government a couple of years ago. Brian, what are the charges Cliven Bundy will be facing?
Yeah, Cliven's the 69-year-old father of Ammon and Ryan Bundy, who led the Malheur wildlife refuge occupation. So after nearly 2 years after that very dangerous standoff at his ranch in Bunkerville, Nevada, he finally got charged, someone finally got charged. There were hundreds of others involved with that who brought very high-powered weapons to basically face down the BLM and FBI who were came to the ranch to round up 900 or so of Clive and Bundy's cattle that were trespassing on public lands. So the federal government intervened finally and arrested Clive at the Portland airport where the elderly rancher had flown into to, visit his sons in jail and make a statement at Burns, Oregon, down by the wildlife refuge, perhaps in support of them. And he was taken into custody, and yesterday they unveiled the charges in a 32-page complaint that is extremely harrowing. It's a very powerful document. And Cliven's charged with six felonies in connection with the Bunkerville standoff. They have to do with interfering with a federal law enforcement officer, extortion, firearms offenses related to those. All told, they could carry up to 42 years in prison if he's convicted on everything. And it seems like they've kind of thrown the book at him with these charges. And I'm glad Jennifer Dobner's here because she was actually at the Bundy Ranch on April 12th of 2014 when things really came to a head and witnessed these scenes described in this complaint. I'm going to just ask Jennifer to talk about what she saw on April 12th. And that was the day that Clive and Bundy allegedly incited hundreds of his quote-unquote followers to head over to the impound yard where the BLM had rounded up 400 head of cattle with the intent of intimidating, again, allegedly, to intimidate the FBI and the BLM to abandon their operation and release the cattle. So,
well, I'll tell you what I saw, and you can decide if it's allegedly or not.
Okay.
So that morning, I was working for Reuters at the time. They had their daily press conference, and they were having it off the back of a flatbed truck, you know, with the sound system and some bunting, and it was, you know, very patriotic, lots of flag flying, very patriotic looking. And Mr. Bundy first, and the sheriff was there of the county, and someone's going to have to help me because I'm drawing a blank on the Nevada county where it is, where Bunkerville is. But anyway, the sheriff was there, and the first thing Mr. Bundy did was demand that the sheriff go and round up all the weapons and demilitarize the BLM and the FBI. And he put a time limit on it, and he said, you're not back here and forget what it was, an hour or 2 hours, we're going to go take back the cows. And there must have been, you know, well over 500, 600, maybe 700 people or more gathered that morning. They essentially, when it didn't happen, when the sheriff didn't come back with the guns, they rushed to their cars and stormed the interstate, backed up, I-15. And there was a standoff on the highway with, some traffic going by and guys with long rifles on their bellies with the nose of the weapon through the cracks in between the concrete barriers on the freeway. And I was there. There's an iconic picture taken by Salt Lake City-based photographer Jim Arcard of one of those guys, and I was there and heard him say that he had a clear shot at a number of federal officers. And I will say, I've been doing this 20 years. It's like not like anything I've ever experienced. And only afterwards, and I was working with Jim at the time, only afterwards did we have the good sense to be afraid. you're in the moment and you're working, but we were there about 5 days at Bunkerville, and the thing that these people are articulating and the fear that they are saying in terms of the federal government coming in to erode their freedoms and shut down their way of life, I think is quite real for them. I personally did not really, I don't experience that in this in b- But it was really a remarkable experience. I'm not really surprised that Bundy's been charged. I think the government.
Are you surprised it took 2 years?
Not really. I think that was a really incredibly tense situation in Nevada, and I think one backfire on that freeway, and it could have erupted into a really bad situation, and a lot of people could have gotten hurt. And I think that after about, I don't know, an hour or so of the standoff, you know, the BLM said, you know, we're leaving and we're releasing the cows. And I think that the activists felt like, you know, that emboldened them. That has produced the Phil Lyman incident in southern Utah, and certainly the situation in Oregon. But I think they've been waiting because they do not want to see things like Waco and Rocky Ridge, and they can't afford those types of incendiary events, and so they've been waiting.
We only have about a minute, Brian.
Sorry.
You're fine. A couple of Utahns figure into this Bundy storyline. Can you just very briefly talk about the arrest that happened yesterday?
Yeah, 7 more people were arrested in connection with the Malheur occupation. Including a gentleman named Wesley Carr of Manti and another man named Blaine Cooper, who actually lives in Arizona, but he was arrested in Utah as well. We're not sure what their roles were. The main leaders are Ammon and Ryan, and Ryan Payne of a Montana militia guy. The two Ryans also feature in the Recapture Canyon ride. And we're also in the truck with Lavoie Finicum, the gentleman who was killed by police during the arrests. Anyway, there are, in the charges filed against Clive and Bundy, there are 4 unnamed co-conspirators who aren't named, but they do say they're in custody in the Malheur case. Clearly, one of them is Ryan Bundy. And Ryan and the others, Ryan Payne, Bundy, and their alleged criminal acts are described. So I have a feeling we'll see Bunkerville related charges against those 4 gentlemen.
That's a fascinating story. We will continue to follow it at the Tribune. Got to take another break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW Salt Lake City, throughout the state on Utah Public Radio.
On the next American Radio Works documentary.
When I look at HBCU, I think of independence.
Historically, black colleges were built in the era of segregation.
It is better for us to go to our own schools.
Today, some black colleges are struggling.
If we are to survive, we've got to change.
Listen for The Living Legacy, Black Colleges in the 21st Century, from APM, American Public Media.
Friday morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Join the community of friendly and talented volunteers who make UPR the vibrant place it is. Our wonderful, dedicated volunteers are a tremendous help to UPR, providing invaluable support to our staff and are excellent ambassadors of the station. You can be a UPR volunteer during the next pledge drive coming up February 20th. To sign up or just to check out the times available, go to upr.org. Thanks.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Time for our final segment, the underplayed story of the week. Dan, would you like to kick us off?
Okay. I'm going to use a dull but important story, and that's the Republican legislature is trying to strip Democrats of power on 2 committees. And one of them is more interesting than the other because one of those committees decides which agencies of the state are audited by legislative auditors. And as we've seen over the years, those can be really big stories. You know, we had the UTA audit, which was, I think, kind of devastating to the agency. We've had this recent one about the adult probation and parole that we talked about and others. And that has always been evenly split between Democrats and Republicans because it was always seen for decades as this is not about politics. It's nonpartisan. And now the Republicans are trying to change that and basically add two Republicans so that the Democrats would be outnumbered, 2-1 on the committee. And, you know, Democrats who have their powers shrunken and shrunken and shrunken over the years are really upset about this and are kind of raising a stink, but there's not much they can do.
Not much they can do. Brian Maffley, what's your pick?
Yeah, on Wednesday morning, we got a tip about federal officers raiding the offices of various businesses associated with the Kingston Klan. And one of them, it seemed like a main target, was a company I've been following for the last year called Washakie Renewable Energies, which claims to be in the